The next case, number 25-1754, United States versus Jose Guzman Vasquez. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please introduce herself on the record to begin?
Good morning. May it please the court. Joanna Leroy for Mr. Jose Guzman Vasquez. May I please reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
You may.
Thank you. Mr. Guzman had been on supervised release for just 2 months when he relapsed, tested positive one time for drugs, and left the halfway house where he was living. Ignoring pleas from the defense for treatment, the district court called this a felony, therefore a grade B violation, and gave him 21 months of imprisonment. And taking the shortcut of...
Could you clear up one thing in the record for me, please? The violation presentation had possession listed separately. So there was a discrepancy in the brief as to whether he admitted as to all of the violations, and if so, possession is separate from the drug use.
Yes, I think if you look at the record as a whole, it is abundantly clear, and we have the record citation summarized in the reply at pages 5 to 7, that what Mr. Guzman was accepting was the underlying conduct, the use, the positive and the admitted
use.
How does this
work in the District of Puerto Rico? So I'm familiar with the District of New Hampshire, where we would have gone through each alleged violation and there would have been a response provided. How does this work in the District of Puerto Rico?
There's no going over reviewing the motion with the defendant before the district court at the end. It's simply
no colloquy between the judge and the defendant about what you're admitting to.
None whatsoever, and I think that's never done.
How does the court get out of something that's said before the court that there's an admission to something?
Because Mr. Guzman stated that he is not contesting the conduct, the use. And if, again, we have to, on appeal.
What words did he use?
He said, we're not contesting the violations, and it challenged at every turn the classification by the probation officer as possession. What the motion by the probation officer provided was notice that the court may decide to qualify this as possession and therefore could challenge.
But did he say we're not contesting, because there were four different violations, did he say we're not contesting the violations plural?
Yes, because there were also failure to report housing and that kind of thing. I think we can't just use that one sentence in a vacuum, and regardless.
If he says we're not admitting the violations, plural, and the notice said there are four violations.
The district court in our case doesn't, because we don't go through the colloquy of every noticed violation by the probation officer, the focus is always on the conduct itself, and that's really clear on the record. There was no a distinction by the court or a question by the court.
Where in the record is the defendant making a distinction between possession and use?
At every turn. Again, there's a summary.
I heard you say at every turn, but where?
So there was a brief filed before the revocation hearing by the defense, and then throughout the actual proceedings before the district court spoke, defense counsel explained over and over and over again.
When you say a revocation hearing in the District of Puerto Rico, that's a sentencing on on an admission you've made on paper?
That can be made in person at the hearing or beforehand.
Here it was made beforehand. He files
saying he's admitting the conduct of use and why it should not. That is not the same as possession. And there's a really important reason for that.
Admitting the violations, and then he does show up and is making this distinction. This is not your case. I guess I'm troubled by this entire procedure, because what this is highlighting is before sentencing this man, nobody ever identified as a matter of fact by preponderance of the evidence what he did. You practice there. How does this comport with any kind of process to make sure everybody knows what he has admitted liability to?
Well, that could be a separate appeal, but I think if you look at the record of a whole, those concerns are resolved in the sense of defense counsel was able to make an extremely clear record of what he was admitting and what he was not. And I think it goes back to the reasoning.
I think possession was violation number one.
It was the condition.
It was violation number one. Is there somewhere in the record that he says we're not admitting to violation number one, but we are admitting to the conduct of 2, 3, and 4?
No, but nor was he asked. And if So that exact sentence as a technicality was not made, but if I may explain why the record really does resolve that distinction, defense counsel explained over and over again that positives are evidence of use. And Congress has explained the significance.
Arguing that because he was asking for release to a treatment center, which I agree was a very good argument to make in this case and was very well done by defense counsel. But even he said, I admit to the conduct, and then went on to argue about being released, but the conduct itself includes possession.
That is the probation officer simply states first that he violated the condition that it prohibits possession, but then in the factual basis for that, simply says that he tested positive once for methamphetamine and admitted to use.
I went to the defense memo, the revocation memo, yes. And it starts out saying the defendant does not contest any of the violations alleged in the United States probation officer's motion.
I think
docket 62. So
I understand that statement, you may read that if just having that admitted the possession, but it's so important to look at the record as a whole, because in the next breath, the memo explains why that doesn't constitute possession. Even if the probation officer put that as a, because at least in our district, there's no importance necessarily given to how the probation officer classified it. Our argument, that was a legal classification. The court found that the use, which is all the conduct that is alleged, necessarily means possession and therefore is a felony. That also that analysis is the error. It necessarily bypasses the entire statutory
violation that fits very neatly your idea that use is distinct from possession. I mean, the idea, I guess, is you can test positive and not knowingly possess drugs. That's a theoretical possibility, but the way to make that apparent is to say, this is the thing I did. I didn't do that thing. I didn't possess the drugs.
So the distinction on mens rea, the knowing or not, isn't logical. And that's why I need to explain the statute, because Congress, Section 3583, which needs to be the starting point, is the supervised release statute, separates positives from possession affirmatively and for a good reason.
Right.
It's to therefore provide a different approach when faced with addiction.
You agree with me that some users who test positive possessed, and some knowingly possessed, and some users may not have knowingly possessed.
Yes, but Congress didn't carve out, didn't affirmatively amend a statute to protect, to make sure that those who are unknowingly possessing get a break. It's addressing addiction. All addiction is knowing. Positives are generally evidence of knowing use. That's what addiction is, and Congress made a judgment.
The problem with this case is that it's not unusual to say, I'll specifically admit to 2, 3, and 4, but we're not admitting to 1.
It is in our jurisdiction.
And therefore, it requires, if they want to go forward with 1, it requires the government to bring in evidence.
I would say, because I practice in that district, and at least in our district, the general practice is to address the conduct itself. There's very rarely any kind of assessment of the state of violations by the probation officer, because that's the probation officer's sort of legal assessment. I think the very fact that there's a use versus a possession condition, it explains why those are two very different things, and the conduct really only indicates use, and it's the defense.
The problem is that you're saying that the court below erred, and we're looking to the record to try to figure out, well, how could the court have erred in that finding if the defendant admitted to it? That's the problem. And if he admitted exactly as Judge Montecalvo said, he admitted or not contesting the violations 1 through 4 without carving out, we'll do 3 but not 1. It's a problem.
Well, there was no opportunity. There is no, that is not how it's done in that district in terms of looking at how the probation officer classified the violations. It's based on the conduct. And again, the record is clear that he did not admit the possession. And again, the distinction shouldn't be about knowing use. He's an addict. He knowingly used. And Congress said, we have a plan for that. And that's G4, that's positives. So to collapse that statutory structure, to go back of 30 years of congressional effort to truly disentangle positives from possession, that's G1 versus G4.
Possesses? Who are those people?
Mr. Guzman, not knowingly possesses, knowingly uses. The idea that that can be possession is a legal conclusion that is error, because it necessarily avoids Congress's plan to have a gradual approach.
I hear who knowingly possesses? What is that person? Can a person, is there such a thing in the world of supervised release as a knowing possessor?
Of course.
Who is that person?
That would be in a world where we're not just dealing with positives. And I would say that's a question for a different day. I get that that could be a slippery slope of factual patterns, but my point here is when a district court is faced
without using, somebody could be
of course
drugs for somebody without
using. Absolutely, absolutely. And that will be what the district court did here in the possession analysis will be the apt analysis. What I'm saying is that when a district court is confronted with just positives, evidence of use, Congress said G4. We added a provision for you guys to consider, and that's a graduated response that includes a treatment-based exception. Why would you have a treatment-based exception if what we're doing is looking out for those who are accidentally taking drugs? Under this district court's analysis, if we're going to just call it possession, call it a crime, call it grade B, a supervisee is better off just refusing the drug test altogether, because that'll be a type C, lower violation, than taking it, testing positive and asking for help from the probation officer. Those policy reasons that Congress considered in doing so.
A better way to do it is just don't admit it.
Exactly. And if or the positive is the same.
Your argument would be sharp if you specifically only admit it to use.
But the positive is the same as admission. It's evidence of the use.
No, I was saying the argument that you make, which is a very good argument, would be a strong argument if there was also not on the record a specific declination of contesting the separate possession.
But I think the problem with those kind of technicalities of it's about the use. Congress is contemplating use, and that's on the in the legislative history of the amendment in 2002. That's saying
decided to charge more than use. Use was there, and charge possession.
And defense challenged that. Defense did not. It said it's, I think the record is clear that what they were accepting was the conduct, which was use.
The problem is, I guess this goes back to my first question. I don't understand your system because you're challenging it at sentencing, but you didn't challenge it at the merit stage. And that's not how we, at least in my experience, that is not how we do this. So I can't get my mind around what you're doing there.
I think I think there is an inherent problem in the conflation of those two proceedings. But I think if you really do look at what was stated at the hearing and in the motion beforehand, is that yes, he accepted that he used drugs. He accepted that, and that's a factual finding that we accept. To then legally classify that as possession grade B in a felony is an error because it necessarily avoids this whole structure that Congress built into Section 3583 that looks at positives separately. And here, especially when we have someone who's out for 2 months, who just had one positive, and he's been a lifelong addict and no treatment or medication, 21 months of imprisonment is unreasonable, and it's in large part due the complete avoidance of, which is presented by defense counsel over and over again, which is why there's also a
Colon Cordero.
Okay, thank you very much.
At this time, would counsel for the government please introduce herself on the record to begin?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Maria Luchter for the government. Now, I would like to jump in and respond to Judge Thompson's question, as well as what Judge Montecalvo indicated, is that Mr. Guzman here admitted the violations. Mr. Guzman's admitted on the revocation memo before the revocation hearing, and I quote.
What do you say about what your sister counsel alleges is the practice in Puerto Rico, which is very odd that people's focus is on conduct and nobody pays any attention to the actual listed violations?
I believe here there was an attention to the list of violations.
How it works? I mean, these are not complicated questions. You practice there. How does the supervised release system work? The probation officer wrote what looked to me like a standard violation report that identified 1 through 4 as the alleged violations of the court-imposed conditions of supervised release, 1 being possession, 4 being use, and 2 and 3 being other failures that are covered by the conditions. What in the District of Puerto Rico happens next in a typical, or this case, or a typical case?
There is generally a preliminary hearing that could be waived, or if the charges are contested, there is a preliminary hearing. Here, I believe it was waived, and then Mr. Guzman filed a revocation memo stating that he did not contest any of the violations as listed in the probation officer's motion.
And as a practitioner from the U.S. Attorney's Office in that district, do you understand that to mean he has generally admitted to some kind of set of facts that might prove some of these violations ultimately, or he can be sentenced on, or he retains some wiggle room, or does that like really viewed as a pleading liability to the four violations?
I mean, here in this case, that's how the district court viewed it. Mr. Guzman specifically admitted to all of the violations as provided in the probation officer's motion and in the sentencing hearing as well stated.
He writes that one thing that has one line that says, I admit to the violations, and then he says a bunch of facts. Then the next step is, and he writes what he'd like the court to do. And then you show up at the court, and the court engages in no colloquy with you about what you have agreed you are liable for. It just proceeds to sentence you?
I am not exactly sure, Your Honor. I have to admit in what the proceedings are. I believe there is a discussion before about whether the violations are contested or not, so that the government would be able to bring witnesses to the court and prepare if the violations are contested. I don't know exactly what that procedure looks like. I have to admit that. But here in this case, Mr. Guzman also admitted the violations before the district court. On page 55 of the record on the revocation sentencing hearing, he says he accepts the violations and the revocation.
Except he's saying that's done under an understanding of a process that doesn't mean what the three of us who don't practice in the District of Puerto Rico think it means. That just means some of the facts will support some of these things. Is that a fair, based on practice, is that a fair way to read it?
I mean, here in this case, the district court had the admissions, and the district court found, based on those admissions, that Mr. Guzman admitted to the guilt that's portrayed in the judgment of the district court. And Mr. Guzman never took issue with the actual revocation based on these violations. Indeed, he has never argued before this court that the district court incorrectly revoked him based on these four violations.
If he had objected to, say, revocation reason number one, there then would have been a hearing where the government would have called the witness
or would have made arguments in support of that. And here we have on the record, we don't only have the violation number one, we also have evidence that supports knowing possession. We have the positive drug test, which this court in Brennick has stated is a powerful scientific evidence supporting possession.
Is there other evidence that
there is also Mr. Guzman admitting to that drug use. So it wasn't only positive drug test, it's admitting to the drug use, and Mr. Guzman has never argued that drug use was unknowing, involuntary, or somehow beyond his control. He's never made that argument. So it was a reasonable inference, even if he had not admitted to the violation number one, for the district to find that Mr. Guzman possessed controlled substances here, and possession of controlled substances is...
You think that all of the stuff your friend points to, which is quite a significant amount of stuff that Congress has distinguished between use and possession, the only purpose for that is the person who, I don't know, picks up a cigarette and it happens to be a marijuana joint, or eats a poppy seed bagel or some other weird thing where they end up testing positive but didn't mean to use drugs? That's all Congress was getting at with all of this distinctions focusing on use? That seems odd.
The Congress did not address of how the possession could be determined. And I think it is important to also properly frame the issue before the court. Mr. Guzman does not challenge the revocation or mandatory revocation under G1 or G4. Mr. Guzman challenges the proper guideline calculation, specifically the classification of the violation, as he himself states on reply on page 12. And the proper classification of the violation is made based on 7B1.1. And there is no carve-out or exception, as Mr. Guzman tries to argue, for a person who was not caught red-handed with drugs, but where the district court made a reasonable inference based on the record evidence that person had possessed drugs. There's a
distinction between treatment and possession. If you use drugs, it's not a mandatory revocation unless there are three violations. I mean, clearly there's a statutory distinction between how Congress sought to deal with people who were addicted.
Again, the issue here is the 7B1.1 and the guideline calculation. And Mr. Guzman admitted to violation number one.
Grade B is that the judge found it was felony drug possession, right? That's what
it is. A simple possession of controlled substances, yes, is a felony possession in Puerto Rico law. Correct.
So that's what makes it a felony. And so that's the thing that triggers it. And they're saying all you have is a use and a test and an admission that I used. And then therefore, it can be found to be felony drug possession. And there seem to be two responses. One would be Congress wanted to treat evidence of just use, where that's all you have, differently. That's one response. And the other response is, you government didn't prove anything beyond, it could be my poppy seed bagel example. So therefore you didn't prove it. And the problem with you didn't prove it is we never got to proof, because you have this odd system where you just say, well, he admitted the violation, and then they're saying they didn't admit the violation. So this, the rubber never met the road on the facts, and then you're left with just the use, and the use is factually doesn't prove anything, because maybe he knew he possessed drugs, maybe he didn't, and you have no evidence that he did.
Again, here, Mr. Guzman admitted to violation number one, the unlawful possession. And to respond to your point about 3583, excuse me, G4 to G1, there is a differentiation there with regard to mens rea. G4 calls for a revocation where there are more than three positive drug tests within 1 year. It doesn't require any mens rea. It could be unknowing. It is calling for a mandatory revocation. Whereas for G1, it's a knowing possession. It's possession of controlled substances in violation of 3583D. And that calls for a mens rea finding. So there is a difference. Those two can exist in harmony.
And that was based on literally the evidence of, one, I had a positive drug test, and his statement that I know I violated G1, the first...
He stated explicitly that he had violated the mandatory condition number two, unlawful possession of controlled substances.
Which is based on the statement Judge Montecalvo read, which is, I admit the violations.
As well, he said the same statement in the district court hearing as well. I admit the violations and the revocation. That's on page 55 of the sentencing.
But it never gets to the granular level of, when you say you're admitting like you knowingly possessed drugs in violation of Puerto Rico law that makes that a felony. Like, we never really get to that with this guy.
The district court judge makes a finding based on these admissions and the record evidence that states that, I revoke you based on those four violations, including possession of controlled substances, which Mr. Guzman never challenged or objected to that specific revocation. And then the district court states on the 7B1.18, two, I believe, I consider it the grade B violation because you had knowingly used controlled substances, which shows possession. And then
it doesn't. By definition, the fact of use does not necessarily show knowing possession. It can, but it doesn't have to. So what evidence brought it over from it can to it has to? Now, other than the fact that he just, in a sort of a gauzy way, admitted to all of the violations, is there some other piece of evidence that was before the judge that said he knowingly possessed?
Mr. Guzman admitted that he had used controlled substances, and that in itself leads to an inference that he had possessed. And I will point this court to this court's decision in Brannick. In Brannick, the same evidence was before the district court judge. Drug positive, which Brannick said was a powerful scientific evidence to demonstrate or to show possession, and two, admission of use. Those were the two pieces of evidence in Brannick, and this court affirmed the district court's finding of a grade B violation there, indicating again that drug positive itself is a powerful scientific evidence. And in that case, as in here, coupled with the admission of knowing use, that was sufficient to find a possession. And in Brennick, they determined that it would even be sufficient to find conviction under New Hampshire law. And thus, the district court did not err in finding a grade B violation. And that same circumstance applies here.
Thank you.
Thank you. I ask that the court affirm.
At this time, would counsel for the appellant please reintroduce himself on the record?
Good morning again, Joanna Leroy for Mr. Jose Guzman Vasquez. I want to first acknowledge Your Honor's concern about what happens in the district court. I do practice there, and I agree that it's somewhat problematic conflation of merit in sentencing. The problem is that traditionally, when confronted with someone, a supervisee using a drug use addiction situation, it's very common that we go to treatment, we do that thing. So it's sort of a new phenomenon that we're dealing with when we get there and we say, yeah, he used, we're asking for treatment, that he calls it a possession, calls it a felony and all of these things. So as a practice in general, we don't have that individualized colloquy, but that would be very helpful for appeals purposes. But also it's, you know, with many judges, or at least historically, when we're confronted with positives, it's always a type C. It's usually we go to treatment. There's this jump to felony conduct is this new thing that some judges are doing. It's very worrisome because it's resulting in sentences that we're seeing here. And I would also want to acknowledge the point where, well, sometimes it's evidence of knowing use or not. I sort of would push back on that being the defining factor here. This is not, as perhaps was proposed to this court in Brennick, a sufficiency of the evidence challenge. It's a legal challenge because when confronted with positives, Congress has said, here's a provision that you're going to follow. We don't have to now get into the analysis if it was knowing or not. It's addiction. By definition, it's knowing.
You say you admitted it. That's like the lead point. And your response today is, I didn't admit it because even though I said I admitted it, the practice in Puerto Rico is that doesn't actually mean what I said.
I think all we have is the record, whether it's a well-done process or not, and the record indicates he did not admit possession. And also that's a legal classification.
When he says, I admit all the violations, the people who exist in your ecosystem understand that not to mean what the three of us who don't live in your ecosystem do think it means.
Well, in the next breath, he says it's not possession. So that's really what is a more of an objective indicator, more so than just who knows how it works and not. And always, always on appeal, we have to look at the full record. And the full record shows that while he accepts the violations in the sense of use, relapse, that's the general force behind it. But this is not possession. And that is clear on the record. So we request that the case be remanded with the instruction to follow the correct scheme and the sentence be vacated.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That concludes argument in this case.